Good evening and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer's conversation with Aston River Road conference call. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Emily. Hello. Welcome back. I'm Dave Snowball, publisher of the Mutual Fund Observer. The Observer has noted in about the last year, with increasing concern and skepticism, the state of the U.S. bond market. If you look at bond fund flows, you'll find that in the last 5 years, retail investors have added $1 trillion to their mutual fund holdings in bond funds while pulling a $500 billion out of equity funds. As that money has continued pouring in, the yield on bond funds across a wide variety of bond types has dropped to the point that even optimists now imagine that the bond market is poised for negative real returns over the next 5 to 7 years. Pessimists believe that it is a bubble ready to pop. Because bonds have long served as this simple, all-purpose, almost brain-free answer to the question of how to control volatility, many folks have gotten into the kind of reflexive habit of adding a slug of treasuries when all else fails. The question for us is, if that strategy can't be relied upon in the future, what sorts of things are we left to do? The Observer has, over the last year, attempted to examine a number of strategies that might help answer that question. None are necessarily complete answers, but each offers investors one possibility should the bond fund bubble pop. In particular, we've tried looking at alternate strategies that are intelligible, well-articulated, and have a track record, and management teams that are deeply invested in those strategies. Our hope is that we'll be able to give you some ideas about possibilities for your own portfolios, for your own clients, and for your own readers. Tonight, we're delighted to have the management team from Aston River Road Long Short, Matt Moran and Daniel Johnson. And the structure of the call is this. I'd like to invite Andrew Beck, president of River Road, to say a little bit about the team and its strategy. Matt is going to introduce the strategy and his fund, and then when he's done, I'll raise some questions with him, and we'll reserve the last third of the call for questions from those of you on the line. With that, Andrew, if you'd be comfortable taking over, sir, I would be honored.
Certainly. Hello, David, and thanks to everyone who have dialed in today. I appreciate you allowing the River Road team to participate on this call. I'm certain that the people who are participating have dialed in specifically to hear from Matt and Daniel. So my role will be to just briefly introduce River Road and perhaps share a word or two about why I am so excited about this strategy and the two managers who are running it. With regard to River Road, we are a boutique institutional investor located in Louisville, Kentucky. We manage approximately $7.2 billion in assets for a wide range of clients located around the world. We have 42 associates at River Road, 15 of whom are dedicated full-time to equity research and portfolio management. While our firm was officially founded in 2005, so we might be new to some of your listeners, our team shares a history that stretches back more than 15 years to the end of 1997. And that is when our partner, Jim Shurcliffe, the firm's CIO, first joined our former employer, SMC Capital, Inc. And I always enjoy pointing out to prospective clients that in our 15-year history, as a team, not a single member of our investment staff has ever left the group. And I like to credit Jim for that track record, who, by the way, has been a professional equity analyst and investor for more than 40 years. Interestingly, Jim ran the target fund at Oppenheimer in the early 1980s when it was a top-ranked special situation fund. In the late 80s, moved on to launch the small cap strategy at Southeastern Asset Management. He's had a bit of a storied career leading up to his starting our firm here in Kentucky, River Road. Prior to launching our long short strategy, our reputation was primarily built on investing in undercovered, I think misunderstood, small cap stocks. In fact, between our small cap strategy and our independent value strategy, both of which are also available through Aston, we held the top spot or the top one percentile ranking in the small cap universe in 2006, 2008, 2009, and 2011. It's been a fantastic track record. I also like to point out that our dividend strategy, which was designed to leverage both small and larger cap opportunities, has also outperformed its benchmark for 8 consecutive calendar years, every year from inception through 2011, which brings me to long short. So, you know, building upon that very strong foundation, during the financial crisis, Jim and I were both drawn to the concept of launching a long short strategy. In our careers, we had both had experience working on long short strategies, but always believed that to be successful, to be truly successful, institutional quality with long short, you needed to be focused on the space. You needed to be dedicated to long short. We also saw during that financial crisis and that period from 07 through 09, just how many of really the most celebrated long short managers were failing to protect their clients' assets. Managers who were charging 2 and 20, who didn't provide liquidity that a mutual fund vehicle provides. So certainly we had an interest in it, but again, we were focused on long-only strategies. Concurrently, our top two analysts at River Road, the two analysts who had contributed significantly to the success of those strategies I mentioned earlier, came up with a unique approach to a long-short portfolio. Jim and I loved it. Of course, it's Matt and Daniel who are on the call tonight. Matt and Daniel have worked closely together for 5-6 years now. I think that they've worked so successfully together in developing the strategy they're going to present tonight because of their complementary skills. Matt has a very strong investment background, having worked at Goldman Sachs, among other firms. He is a University of Chicago CFA. He has what we like to call a passion bordering on obsession, to steal a quote from David Swensen. He is a leader inside the firm that is complemented by Daniel Johnson, whose background prior to joining River Road was more in accounting. Master's in accounting, worked for Price Waterhouse, exceptional analytical skills. So we were able to border the accounting side of the analysis, which is so critical on the short side, discovering and analyzing those opportunities, with Matt's demonstrated success primarily on the long side. We also believe that having these two unique assets in our firm, that a long-short structure would be the highest and best use for their skills. So we put the strategy through a rigorous multi-year testing process, which is standard for River Road, during which we only invest our own money. It has also undergone the rigorous analysis performed by our partners at Aston. And I think that process, by the way, both what we conduct here internally at River Road and at Aston, is a reason why this firm has never launched in our 15-year history a strategy that has failed to deliver to clients against objectives. So today I couldn't be more thrilled not only to introduce Matt and Daniel, but also to inform your listeners that I'm a significant investor and to invite them to be one as well. And to set the stage for Matt and Daniel, I can tell you that results have been great during the history of the strategy. They have delivered over 12% annualized returns since inception. That is outperforming their Morningstar peers by more than 5 times and their hedge fund peers by a much larger amount. They've done so with a beta of spot 3.4 and a standard deviation of just 8.39%. I mean, very, very exceptional performance. They've demonstrated this skill both on the long and the short side of the portfolio, which I think is even more impressive. Their long stocks have beaten the benchmark by nearly 9%, and their shorts by 18.5% since inception. And today, they actually hit a new all-time high watermark in their portfolio. So it's all moving in the right direction. With that, again, thank you for participating. I will turn it over to Matt.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, David, and thanks everyone for tuning in tonight. We are thrilled about this opportunity to introduce our long-short strategy. Here at River Road, we are surrounded by great investors, and we are not bashful about emulating or even stealing from some of the greatest investors around. And as we designed this strategy, We look to A.W. Jones. We learn from A.W. Jones, who started the first hedge fund back in 1949. And back then, he didn't have all the fancy tools that we have today, right? He didn't have ETFs and derivatives. What he had was a simple approach. He bought good companies, he shorted bad companies, and he managed his risk. And by doing that, he produced some of the best risk-adjusted returns in the money management business over the ensuing couple of decades, on par with Mr. Buffett. So we've tried to model our strategy in a similar tradition. We've tried to keep it simple. We don't have a black box. Big picture, what we're trying to do is threefold. We're trying to produce equity-like returns with substantially less volatility and an emphasis on capital protection. Specifically, we're trying to beat the market by up to 200 basis points over a full market cycle. How are we going to do it? Well, it's going to be driven by stock selection. Look, if you have less than 100% exposure to the market, you had better pick good longs and shorts if you want to outperform or produce those equity-like returns. On the long side of the portfolio, it's a concentrated, high-conviction portfolio of our very best ideas. Oftentimes, we steal them from other managers at River Road. It's 15 to 30 names that make up 50 to 100% of the portfolio. We're buying excellent companies with predictable and sustainable cash flows and businesses that we can understand. One of our largest positions today is Molson Coors. It's beer. We can understand beer. It's the world's third largest or most often drank beverage behind water and tea. Again, it's 15 to 30 names, just 50 to 100% of the portfolio. And Molson Coors has been doing this for a long time, right? It's very predictable. They've been selling beer in Canada since 1786 and here in the States since 1873. It's a business that we can get our arms around. When we buy these companies, we're trying to buy them at compelling prices. And this gets to our absolute value philosophy. We're not deep value investors that are willing to buy metal benders at a fraction of their book value. Nope. And we're not relative value investors. We're not going to buy the hopes and the dreams of many companies out there. No, we're going to stick to the here and the now. That's the long side. On the short side, and this is what most folks want to hear about, right? Because we come from a long-only shop, and they're very aware that a lot of long-only investors have taken a stab at long-short investing and stubbed their toe when it comes to shorting stocks. And we've learned a lot. We've done our research. We've modeled ourselves after the very best in the business, the best that we could find. The Feshbach brothers in the 1980s, Chanos in the 90s, David Rocker, Einhorn, Loeb. These are the guys that we admire, respect, and really appreciate. And we've learned a lot, right? Because when we first started shorting stocks, we were attracted, like moth to a flame, to those stocks that are trading at 100 times earnings, valuations that we couldn't understand. And as value guys, we thought those were the best things to short. But what we learned over time is that oftentimes those are mediocre to good to very good businesses that can grow into those valuations over time. And we sleep a whole heck of a lot better shorting challenged business models. Think about Ben Graham, right, and that cigar butt, that last puff. Those are the kind of things we want to short. You know, we want to short companies that can't earn their cost of capital. Airlines come to mind. We've been short AMR last year. We were short Delta this year. Delta has got the oldest planes, more debt, pensions, and long-term debt than any other airline out there. They've got unions. They've got competitors moving into their largest hub in Atlanta. This is the kind of thing we want to short. Companies that don't do any free cash flow. One of our largest shorts today is a company called Goodyear Tire, which is the third largest tire manufacturer in the world, actually. And bulls think that it's going to bounce as auto volumes come back. We disagree. We think they've shut down too much of their production and their capacity to do that. You look at their track record, it's not good. They've done $7 a share of restructuring charges over the last several years. They've never done any free cash flow. The Chinese tariffs are just rolling off here recently. They've got the second worst pension in the S&P 500. These are the kind of things that we want to be short. Airlines, newspapers, rural telecom companies that can't afford their dividend. That's the first part of it, challenge business models. Now, the second thing that we learned is that momentum matters, right? Because if you're shorting stocks, well, in the old days, you used to get paid to short stocks before interest rates were artificially held down. Well, today that is the case, and you have to pay to play. So you have to find a way to get the timing right. Now, some folks do channel checks. They try to get the quarter right. But as value investors, we know the terminal value of most businesses are in the out years cash flows. And look, that's just not what we do. Some guys are great at technical analysis. That's not our core competency. What we've come across is momentum. You know, because we don't want AOL to cost us 10,000 basis points like it did Chainos in the 90s, right? We want to stay out of the way of freight trains. It's objective. It's quantitative, in fact. And what we do is we look at all the shorts in our universe, we put them into deciles based on both earnings and share price momentum. And we won't short a stock that's in the top half of that momentum. So as Andrew mentioned, our numbers have been good thus far. Now, we're trying to beat the market over time, but we're trying to do it with half the volatility of the market. How are we going to do that? Well, why are we going to do that? I'll tell you why we're going to do it. It's because I've got 100% of my liquid net worth in this strategy, and Daniel does too. We eat our own cooking. We believe in what we're doing. But we also want a smoother ride. So that comes down to risk management. Andrew talked about the great managers we have here at River Road, and boy, do we. But something he didn't mention is that they're putting up great numbers and they're doing it with a heck of a lot less risk than other managers. In fact, if you look at every long-only strategy at River Road, what you'll find is this. In the last 3 years, each one of them in their respective Morningstar categories scores in the top percentile for the lowest standard deviation. So we appreciate and respect risk at River Road. So how are we going to do half the volatility of the market? Well, first, we keep our exposure to the market, our net market exposure, between 50 and 70%. That gets us a lot of the way there towards that objective. Now, beyond that, we're just going to execute on the fundamentals of risk management. Unlike a lot of other value investors, we don't average down. We will not throw good money after bad. We don't think, as Bill Miller once pontificated, that the lowest cost wins. No, our hero is Paul Tudor Jones. And above his computer, he's got a sign that says losers average losers. We agree. We set stop losses on every long and every short in both portfolios. We're trying to produce consistent and steady absolute returns. We cannot have a long or a short destroy either one of those portfolios. And on the short side, everyone knows that you can make 100% and you can lose infinity. Although I've seen a lot more stocks at zero than I have at infinity, but the point is still the same. You have to be careful on the short side in particular. We have an unrealized loss discipline that we share with every other strategy at River Road. What this is it measures the unrealized losses in both the long and the short portfolios and takes that number as a percent of the total value of the portfolio. And that is great because it allows us, and once that, and we have a threshold, 2%. Once that crosses 2%, we're forced into action. We have to start to take our medicine. We have to look at our longs and our shorts, think about the fundamentals, think about the momentum, think about the valuation, what are insiders doing, and so concentrated bets we may be making in certain sectors. Think about all those things as we're then forced to trim those losers. And I got to tell you, that's been a huge help since inception. Earlier this year in 2012, we had too big of a bet on the short side in housing-related names and economically sensitive types of companies, but this discipline took care of that problem systematically. The final thing as it relates to risk management is momentum. As I mentioned on the short side, we always monitor it, and we want to stay out of the way of freight trains. And just capping off the third part of our three-tiered objective is capital protection. This is critical. most long short funds, hedge funds, mutual funds, and otherwise, violated this in 2008 and 2009. And in fact, in 2011, we had the second worst year for hedge funds over the past two decades. So we want to protect capital. And I think as we developed this, we thought about equities and we understood that they are, I think most of us would agree, the best performing asset class over very long periods of time. Now, our view is that the major problem with this asset class are the major drawdowns that are associated with it. They're emotional. They can result in poor and emotional decisions. They also, and more importantly, kill the rate at which capital can compound. Think if you were a Japanese investor and you started your investment back in December of 1989. Here we are 24 years later, you're still down 70% on your investment. Domestically, in this country, we've had two 50% plus peak to trough declines. So, and if you have if you have these kind of declines, think about every G7 country. Over the last 100 years, they've had at least one 75% drawdown. You need 300% to get back to even, or 15 years at 10%. It's tough, right? Don't lose money. That's the key. So we're capping our maximum drawdown at 10 to 15%. How are we going to get there? Well, it's through our net market exposure management. As I mentioned, we keep our exposure between 50 and 70% most of the time. Daniel and I, our core competency, we can get into this when we get to Q&A, but we want to keep our heads down and we want to find the very best longs and the very best shorts that are out there per our process. We don't want to have to make a decision about Spanish unemployment or the comments from Draghi, because that's not our core competency. We want to keep our heads down and pick stocks, right? So we keep it between 50 and 70% most of the time. But it's important to get outside of that range for a couple of different reasons. One is proactive and the other is reactive. Now, we've kept our allowable range for exposure to the market very wide, 10 to 90%. So, proactive. We have a proactive measure, which is our discount to absolute value indicator. And what that is a look at our top 20 longs, and it takes a weighted average of those top 20 longs as a percentage of their absolute value. Now, we won't buy a stock if it's trading at more than 80% of what we think it's worth. So we're not going to buy the portfolio if it's trading at more than what we think it's worth, or more than 80% of the absolute value. So we'll bring our exposure down below 50% in those cases. We're trying to proactively get in front of a bear market, and then vice versa when things get very cheap. We have a reactive measure, what we call our drawdown plan. We think this is unique. We think it's a differentiator. We know of no other long-short managers that have something quite like this. In fact, we think that it has been a huge benefit in 2011 as things got dicey, and it will be in the future as the markets continue to be very volatile. Well, what is it? Well, the drawdown plan is really our way to get out of the way. And the way it works is simple. When the portfolio, not the market, but the portfolio loses 4% from its high watermark, we start to get out of the way. We take our exposure to a 50%. If we continue to lose money, we're down 6%, we'll take our exposure to 30%. And then finally, if we're down 8%, we'll take our exposure to just 10%. We want to protect capital, unlike a lot of other long short funds did in 2008, 2009, and even 2011. Because look, Daniel and I's view is very simple. If we can protect the capital, there will always be another opportunity to deploy it. We believe that wholeheartedly. But when Daniel and I went to Andrew and the others on the executive committee, as we were designing the strategy, we told them, guys, look at this. From October of 07 to March of 09, the market's down 57%, and we are down, this is back-tested, we are down 10 to 12%, and that assumes no alpha. And they said, that's great. Way to go, guys. But what are you going to do when the market doubles from March 09 to today? You can't stay at 10%. You have to find a way to get out. You have to both protect and participate. So you know, our first instinct was to go to the valuations. We're value guys. But what we learned in our due diligence is that oftentimes just doesn't work. That was a big part of the problem back in the fall of 2008, in particular for long-short managers. And we can walk through that in the Q&A if you like. The next thing is technicals. And again, this is we're not Fibonacci guys. We don't know how to do stochastics. We know how to buy good companies and short bad ones. So we had to come up with something very simple and understandable that was also effective. So what we end up using is the Russell 3000 50-day moving average. And when that moving average ticks positive, we're forced to get back into the market, a minimum of 30%. Daniel and I went back and looked over the past 40 years of every single bear market. Typically, that is the all-clear signal. You should start to invest, start to get back into the market. Occasionally, there are massive head fakes. And again, we are trying to protect capital. That's one of our that objective is just as important as the other two. So we wait for 10 consecutive positive days in the 50-day Russell 3000, 50-day moving average to get back inside that normal 50 to 70% range. So I think, David, that really is kind of a big picture overview of how we think about long, short investing in general and how we apply that to River Road in particular.
Well, thank you. That's an awful lot for folks to kind of mull about. I'll note that at the Observer we do have a profile of the fund that does walk through some of those same points if you want to go back over them kind of at your leisure. I thought what I would do is start with a few questions and then see how the folks on the line are and find out if they have questions as well. You'd mentioned, and Andrew had as well, that most long-short strategies are pretty abysmal. And I didn't know if you had a sense of whether that's a systematic problem. That is it just generically hard to do, or do you see most long-short guys doing the same thing wrong over and over?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. And I think that my answer would be as follows. You know, when what appeals to us about long short investing is that if you are a good investor, this is a natural extension of that. This is the highest and best use of an investor. So we went back. I mean, if you think about what A.W. Jones did back then when he kept it simple, he did 23% per annum for over 20 years. And even if you look here more recently, if you look at the hedge fund indices, right, and you look at the HFRX, and since 1990, they've more than doubled the benchmark. So I think, first of all, that longer term, now that's why long-short equity investing makes up the largest slice of alternative investments, because it really works if you're a good stock picker. Now, you're right. Over the last couple of years, long-short strategies have stubbed their toe. They have and as we've gone out and talked to advisors, we get this all the time. We understand that they're a little disillusioned. They were sold a bill of goods and they're not collecting. Mm-hmm. And we think that really a lot of it is too much macro. I mean, stick to what you're good at, right? And we designed that with that in mind, right? So we kept our exposure between 50 and 70%, so we participate. So when I wake up every morning, and one day I'll see that consumer confidence is hitting new five-year highs, I'll wake up the next day and I'll read that rail freight has just turned over. And I don't know what to make of that. I can hear something about Europe every single day. But what I do know is that Harris Teeter is going to sell more groceries in North Carolina next year than they did this year. And that's what we're going to stick with, what we know and what we understand. So I think that a lot of folks have gotten too far off the path and been able to – it's an advantage to be able to move your exposure around, but it's also a disadvantage if that's not what you're real good at. And I think that a couple other things I would add to that is a lack of focus. You know, Andrew mentioned this. We really think that if you're going to run a long-short strategy, you need to run a long-short strategy. You shouldn't be on a long-only fund. I mean, it requires a trader's mentality. It requires a 100% laser-like focus. And as I mentioned, Daniel and I are both 100% committed to this personally and professionally. Others that we've seen are, I think that pretty much sums it up, actually.
Okay. So, you know, if I understand it correctly, then you think that a lot of the folks botched the strategy by some combination of getting distracted by the amount of noise in the market. That is, they're forever trying to guess what's going on, and they get distracted by having obligations other than their long-short strategy. So their attention is divided, and that keeps them from sort of making the fullest advantage of it.
I agree with that. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I think that some folks view it as kind of a pet project, and shorting is very much a different thing.
Okay. Yeah, and I was wondering, because in part you had mentioned that you had to be focused, and for just a second I wasn't sure if you were concerned that people were picking too many shorts, too many longs. Some of the managers are at 120 short positions and 60 long positions, which is a lot more than you folks have chosen to do.
Right. Well, I think that's another good point. I think what we've learned is that high conviction concentrated portfolios probably work the best over time. And I think that some folks that are trying to short that many names probably fall into more of the quantitative managers or even the pairs traders managers, where they're, you know, they might like General Motors, so they'll short Ford. You know, we don't do that. We want every long and every short to stand on its own. And you know, we don't have, we just feel like if you have, why buy your 76th best idea when you've got 30 great ones?
David, another thing we noticed is our intense R&D research was many of the long-short managers had a core competency on the long side, and as they implemented a long-short strategy, instead of identifying individual shorts, they stuck with ETFs or just some driven by some macro opinion. So that's not their core competency. We wanted to leverage our fundamental work on both the long and short side and express that bet through individual stock positions.
Right. Daniel's exactly right. Some folks do it just to hedge.
Right.
You shorting as a very much an opportunity to make money.
So a lot of folks would short an airlines ETF. You manage to test Delta individually.
Exactly right.
Oh, cool. And having flown Delta, frankly, they deserve whatever kind of account you can have upon them. I spent rather too much time sitting in the Cincinnati hub wondering what I had been thinking when I booked this thing. And so could you tell me a little bit about long stock selection? One of my readers, Dave Reddish, had been kind of curious in looking through the stuff about your focus on the concept of a discount to absolute value. That is, you establish a stock's absolute value, and then you look at them if they're at they're discounted at least 20% to absolute value. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
And David, I'll take that one.
Sure. And so could you give us the, 20-cent answer to, and so what is absolute value? How do you find it?
Yeah, sure. Matt described the philosophy earlier, but the absolute value is effectively our intrinsic value. It's what we think the stock is worth. And we primarily use EV to EBITDA to value our companies and come up with an absolute value. So what we do is we look out 12 to 18 months, and we estimate the cash flows, the operating cash flows of the business.
Daniel, just a second.
Yeah.
Because, I'm sorry, I get confused almost immediately. EV to EBITDA, and so EV is enterprise value?
Correct.
Okay. And then EBITDA is sort of an adjusted earnings, yes?
Correct.
Okay.
It's effectively the operating cash that the business generates each year.
Right. Okay. So you have to start by generating enterprise value. The enterprise value, that's where you're looking out 12 months?
No. We're looking out 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
To estimate the cash flow or EBITDA that the business will generate.
Okay.
And what then we apply a multiple to that cash flow to come up with the absolute value. Now, the multiple we apply to the cash flow is driven by both public and private transaction comps. So, for example, Molson Coolers that Matt mentioned earlier, we're going to look at where Anheuser-Busch has traded over the past 10 years, 5 years, or more recently, or where transactions in the space have taken place. Now, transactions have taken place between 12 and 14 times. Anheuser's traded closer to 11 to 12 times. And then we also look at some other competitors. We actually use a 10 times multiple on Molson Coors to get to our absolute value.
Okay. And when you say transactions have taken place, do you mean buyouts or?
They can be strategic or private equity.
Okay. And so for someone like Molson's, you're looking at an absolute value roughly 10 times earnings. Is that?
10 times cash flow.
10 times cash flow. And then you look for a discount to that?
That is correct. So given that we run a concentrated best ideas, we only have 15 to 30 slots.
Mm-hmm.
So we require a minimum of 20%. However, we look for and really try to find 25% or greater discounts.
Sure. If you kind of look at the long portfolio as a whole, what does the collective discount look like?
You know, as of this morning, it was about 77 or 78%. This most recent run in the market, it's gotten a little bit more pricey.
Okay.
So that's where it was today.
And so you're kind of creeping up toward this 80% threshold. Does that mean that you're going to have to start selling those, or you merely stop buying them, or?
Well, you know, David, it's a very natural extension of the way we run money. Some folks ask us, what is cash to us? And cash to us is always a residual. It's if we can't find anything to buy on the long side, cash will build up, and vice versa. And I would tell you that the very first time that discount to absolute value indicator was triggered for us and our long-short strategy was September 13th, when Mr. Bernanke announced QE Infinity. And Daniel and I were very relieved. And you know, after today's run-up, we'll have to check tomorrow morning, but it might very well be close to that 80% threshold. And so it was very easy for us to not only trim back some of those longs, but also short a lot of different things. We have over 100 names on our short watch list that are ready to go. We're waiting for two things. We're waiting for those shorts to be overvalued enough, which days like today help, and they can't have momentum. So, you know, just pull up any stock chart, and one that's going from, you know, straight up from left to right, we're not going to be in that. If you look at the IBD 50, right, those stocks with the most momentum, you know, you're not going to find us shorting a Lululemon or a Michael Kors or a 3D Systems, those things that make up the top 15 today.
Okay. So at base, when you say you're not going to be shorting Michael Kors, it's there are too many people still piling into it, and so that's the freight train you're trying to dodge?
You got it. Yeah, and we always want to remember that's the nature of capitalism, right, is that over time most stocks don't win out. What drives those index returns over time is a handful of stocks that have a lot of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book recently called What's Behind the Numbers by John DelVecchio. He runs the Active Bear ETF. He starts out his book on page 9 and he says, most stocks lose money. And
right.
We agree with that. So we want to make sure that we're in those stocks, not while they're going up, but while they're going down.
Okay, cool. I want to ask just two other questions before we check in with Emily to see if folks on the line had questions for Matt and Daniel, because I do want to kind of respect our hour time limit. So, Emily, if you want to take a second, ma'am, and let the folks know how, if they wanted to ask questions, they could let you know that.
Sure. To ask a question, you may press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that you pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star and then two. And again, it's star and then one to ask a question.
Cool. And so let's talk about the long-term kind of strategy, the long-term kind of risk-return profile, just to make sure that I understand. Over what you refer to as the full market cycle, you think that you can outperform a broad equity measure by about 200 basis points?
Yes.
And so what qualifies as a full market cycle for that calculation?
Well, we look at We think, to be fair, it needs to be peak to peak and trough to trough. We think over either one of those, we will outperform by 200 basis points or more.
Okay.
For those reasons that we mentioned, right? By making sure we participate in the up markets, protect in the down markets. And when we say participate, we don't want to fight the Fed. We don't want to fight the tape. And then picking good stocks throughout all markets.
Yeah. And it's more a question as we try to imagine any strategy is going to outperform in some instances, underperform in others. And so the question is, how much time does a manager reasonably ask for the kind of strategy to pan out? And so as we talk about a full market cycle, are you thinking something in the 5 to 7 year range? Is that the sort of normal rhythm of these things? Or
David, this is Andrew. I might comment on this.
Hi, Andrew.
Some standards here at River Road around that. As Matt mentioned, we typically look, analyze it both trough to trough and peak to peak. Historically, that period has been 5.3 years. It tends to align well with the profit cycle. We also look at corporate profits over a cycle. So I think that 5 years, generally speaking, is a reasonable expectation period. Now, 5 years is a long time for investors. We would expect that in that period you'll see some outperformance, some underperformance. I think what's most important is style consistency. I think that if the manager is doing what they've said they're going to do, you're seeing that reflected in the returns. There's no issue hanging on for 5 years. But that's the standard that we hold our managers to internally.
Mm-hmm. And so we talk then about kind of lagging performance. There's certainly the question of, lagging the market. And then there's also the question of sort of negative absolute returns. Your maximum drawdown as you modeled the strategy through the kind of bad time in 07 to 09, I think you said was 10 to 12% was the max drawdown. Is that?
That's correct.
Okay. And so as you then think about the strategy in terms of volatility reduction, Andrew had at the beginning of the call talked a little bit about where beta has been at about 0.34. Is that something that you're able to manage the portfolio toward that level of beta, or is that just sort of residual of all of the other things you're doing?
David, I'll tell you, if you look at our net market exposure, it's between 50 and 70%. We think on average we'll be 60% exposure to the market. And so that would imply a beta of about 0.6. But as Matt mentioned earlier, we do a couple things here at River Road that further lowers the beta. One is it's the type of stocks we buy on the long side. We're sort of boarding value investors, and we're buying grocery stores and prisons. So these stocks typically have lower betas. And while we're certainly not out there trying to find high beta shorts, our shorts tend to be slightly higher beta than the market.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a slight beta mismatch, which lowers our beta from what you would expect based on our net market exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, we execute on the fundamentals of risk management. Matt mentioned these earlier as well. And this further reduces the risk in our portfolio, and that comes through in the beta. We think over time our beta will range between 0.3 and 0.5. We just happen to be at the lower end of that range, mainly due to the drawdown in 2011. We spent quite a bit of time at 10% exposure to the market, so that had an impact on our beta.
Cool. That's great. So 0.3 to 0.5 on the downside, that is the beta over the long term, about 200 basis points above the market over that same sort of long term. That helps a lot. Thank you, guys. Emily, I didn't know if you had folks who had questions for the guys.
Yes, we do have one from Richard Falk. Please go ahead.
Good evening. Thanks for holding this call. I've got three questions, I guess, that are a little bit different from one another. The first is just to talk about the benchmark for a moment. It looks like on your site you're using the Russell 3000. What does the category use? So if we're trying to do some sort of comparison to a certain degree between long-short funds, is there a consistent benchmark that is being used or not? So maybe you can comment about benchmark in that class. Second thing is, what's the relationship with Aston? And so why didn't this just come out as a River Road fund by itself? And so maybe you can talk about that. And then the third piece is there a, we always talk about maximum size of portfolios, but is there a minimum size that this portfolio can run and still be in the marketplace, you know, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, because we've seen some funds disband for not having enough money. So appreciate your time.
Cool. Thanks, Richard. And you, if you want to hang on, bud, you might
be
able to listen to the guys, and if they get evasive, you can slap them upside the head.
All right. Sounds good.
Hey, Richard, this is Andrew. I'll address questions number two and three because I think they're specific to sort of product design here at River Road. And I'll let Matt address the first question. So I think the second question was the relationship with Aston. When we launched our firm in 2005, we were partnered with ABN AMRO. We made the decision that we wanted to focus our resources on the manufacturing side of the business. In other words, Jim, myself, and the others here, we're money managers. We're not salespeople. And so to the extent that we could have high-quality business partners that would provide distribution support, we would certainly be that was attractive to us. And so when we partnered with ABN AMRO, they provided a sub-advised, co-branded mutual fund for each of our strategies. That mutual fund group that was ABN AMRO ultimately became Aston. In fact, their CEO today, Stuart Bilton, is the man most responsible for helping us develop River Road. So it's been a strong partnership since we launched the firm in 2005. They've been a great partner. But, you know, despite the success that we've had to date, they put each of our new strategies through a very, very rigorous institutional review process. And we couldn't be more thrilled to partner with them. So it allows us to focus. Essentially, having Aston as a partner allows us to focus on the manufacturing aspect of the business.
So do they actually have the power to, quote-unquote, fire you and bring in a different team to run that strategy or not?
Well, no, because it's co-branded.
Yeah.
So they could essentially...
Sure. Yeah. You used the word sub-advisor before, and I just wanted to make sure I was correct in that in the co-branding. So, okay.
So first question, yes, that's number one. The second, we don't want to run our own mutual funds. I don't want to manage a team of wholesalers. I don't want to be distracted with that business. I want everybody here focused on the process of running money. And they've come up with a very unique, attractive model for that. The second piece is how long can we run this strategy? River Road has a very, very well-designed business model around how we launch new strategies. Our typical model is that a strategy will reach target profitability in 8 years. I want to say again, that's 8 years. Not 2 years, not 3 years, that's 8 years. We don't launch a bunch of new products and then see what works. So we have to have successful established products and in order to support our new products over the long term. And so we manage that process very carefully. Again, I think that's a reason why we've never launched a product that's failed. We do it very, very carefully. So I can tell you, I'm a significant investor in the strategy, as are all of our partners here at River Road. And to me, as long as these guys are delivering on what they're promising to you, their style consistent, you know, they're doing a good job of picking these stocks, I don't care if it takes 5 years, if it takes 10 years. We're partnered with Aston. If a fund has losses over and above our expense cap, we jointly cover those losses. And I have no issue writing that check. And Aston has a long history of being supportive of these strategies. It's not a matter of economics so much as it is, are we delivering to the investment objective of the fund?
Yeah. Richard, this is Matt. You know, just to follow up on what Andrew's points were, I would say that, look, we are not trying to, we didn't start this long-short strategy because that's where the money's flowing, and it is flowing into long-short strategies. We started this long-short strategy because we respect those pioneers. Those guys, the Buffetts, the Steinhardt, the Soros, those guys, you know, if you think about the history of long-short investing, right, it was all things were great until the late 1960s. And then they decided that shorting wasn't so important. And they not only stopped shorting, they went levered. They used leverage to just go long, and they all got destroyed. So we want to run this with a laser-like focus on alpha, and that's what we really are trying to do. And River Road is backing us up 100%. As it relates, Richard, to your question about benchmarks, That's a tough question, and everybody that is in the hedge fund business struggles with this. As far as the mutual funds go, I think you can really measure us probably against three different benchmarks. Here at River Road, we use Morningstar. They've got, about 185 different long-short funds that they put into that category, and that's growing all the time. I think what you'll see over time is they'll probably be a little bit more slicing and dicing. At least I hope that's the case. I think there might be some in there that are a little, maybe just a bit too much long only, or even asset allocation funds. I think you'll get more to kind of the hedged equity, the directional long short managers that we are. In addition to Morningstar, you could also look at Lipper as a benchmark. They do a very good job. And then finally, I think over time you really need to compare us probably to the hedge fund guys, the HFRX or the HFRI Equity Hedge Index.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Cool. Were there other questions, Emily?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one.
And while we wait to see if other folks on the line had questions, I was curious about something you had written in the third quarter commentary, which was, as you came out of the quarter, your internal measures were flashing extremely overvalued, which was leading you to some greater caution. I didn't know in the months since you had written that whether or not the problem with overvaluation has been getting worse and what you think might be driving it.
You're right. As I mentioned, September 13th was the day that it crossed over 80%, and that was the high of the market. And really, we stole this from the small cap guys at River Road. They've been measuring this since 2005. It's been a ridiculously effective predictor of near-term market performance. And here, as we enter this Santa Claus rally, it's now bumping up against 80% here again. But I would say that after it sold off, kind of in November, we were able to find some stuff, on the long side. Stocks like DirecTV, Viacom, big companies that do a lot of free cash flow, that are run by guys that are buying back a ton of stock, that are both burdened with kind of short-term issues that we think they'll overcome. I think you could look at energy names that have gotten relatively attractive here lately, that are almost pricing in another 2008 and 2009. We are finding stuff to buy. And just as it relates to energy, we do something. I said most of the time we just we buy our favorite longs, we short our favorite shorts. Occasionally, we do use hedges. And when it comes to energy, we're buying our favorite longs. We're buying Occidental. We're buying National Fuel Gas. We're buying Devon. But we're shorting out the commodity risk with the USO and the UNG, those structurally flawed ETFs. So we're finding stuff to do. In fact, here recently we're 85% long, 25% short. So we got a gross over about 110, netted about 60. We feel very good about our long book and our short book at this time.
Okay, cool. One of the other questions that Dave Reddish had written in was about your use of stop loss orders. And how they might react in the case of another event, kind of like the sort of flash crash. And he was wondering if stop limit orders might have been safer, or if there was, or if he was misreading that.
Yeah, sure, I'll take that one. I guess I get all the technical questions. But our stop losses, as Matt mentioned earlier, we set those on both the long and short portfolios. They are certainly tracked in our system and monitored by our chief risk officer, but we do not put those trades into the trading system until the stock has actually exceeded the stop loss. So in an event like the flash crash, we would not have those positions into the trading system. Now, stop losses, they're a guideline that is strictly enforced, but we will, of course, apply common sense to an extraordinary event in the market like a flash crash where, you've got Johnson & Johnson or P&G that trade down 60%. in 1 day. So these are strictly enforced, but we're, of course, going to apply common sense.
Right. And so, and
does that answer your question?
I think part of Dave's concern, if I read the question correctly, is that for some folks, the stop losses are triggered automatically by computers rather than by humans saying,
yep,
no, this doesn't feel right, and then holding off and executing them. And so is that the point of the common sense?
Right, right. So those are not driven by computers. Those are put in by myself and Matt and tracked by our systems and monitored by the chief risk officer.
Okay. Emily, other questions?
Yes, we did have a couple come in. The next question comes from Alan Booth. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question really was, is it a dynamic or a static process that you're using with your metrics? As you find that the market changes and you've had a plan that you've set up retrospectively based upon previous market conditions, if you find that it's not working out exactly as you'd expected, do you change those metrics?
You know, I think that we've designed this strategy to be robust and to move around with different market conditions. So I think that we always, and I'm not sure I'm really answering your question, and please follow up if I'm not. We don't want to just sit there when the market's going up, right? We want to participate when the market's up, and by keeping some hedge fund guys, they keep their exposure at 10 or a very low exposure to the market. So we want to participate when the market's going up. We want to find good stocks, long and short, during all time periods.
Let me see if I can clarify the question. Are you asking, so for example, in a variety of market environments, will, say, the valuation we have on a stock, the multiple we use applied against our EV to EBITDA, will it change?
No, really, what I'm asking is, you've set up metrics, I presume, for your strategy, and you've clarified that you set up these metrics on the strategy based upon different market conditions, and so your expectation is that those metrics are going to be repetitive, that they're going to work. If you find out that they're not working exactly as you had expected or as your model had shown, would you adjust the model?
I think that we would, obviously, but what we have done is that we don't want to look. We keep our heads down and try to find great stocks, long or short, most of the time. Only when market gets a little dicey do we go outside of that range. And if the market craters, if we have another bear market, our drawdown plan, those numbers, those metrics that we use, the down 4, the down 6, the down 8. They're there for a reason, right? Because we know that when we get in that down 8, the market's down about 20%. And typically when you have a market down 18 to 20%, a lot of times it goes down even further. Your average bear market's down between 35 and 40%. So you're right in that no market is the same as we go through time. And last year, as the market was down 20%, and we were at the lowest level of our drawdown plan, the market bounced right away. And I think that if you look at most hedge fund guys, you look at their August and September numbers of last year, they lost a lot of money. And we didn't because we had a drawdown plan in place. Now, it hurt us last year, but over time I think that will work out well.
I think Daniel's point too, the common sense rule applies. So we've developed a set of metrics that we've extensively back-tested that we're going to follow it along with in any market environment. If there's some extraordinary reason that presents itself, something that you could not have foreseen, then the common sense rule is going to apply. There's nothing in a computer here. There's nothing that says that we cannot override the model. Again, common sense. But I think there would have to be some very compelling reasons to override the model as established.
Great. Emily, we're running right up close to the top of the hour. Could we pick up one more question?
Sure. The next question is a follow-up from Richard Falk. Please go ahead.
Sure. Just two quick questions. We've talked about this kind of a thing before, but when you have a fund like this, do you have a suggestion as far as its place in a portfolio? So, in
good
other
question,
words,
is this
a piece for, thank you, for your stock piece, your stock and bond piece? Maybe you can just address that part. And then the second question, even though in the Mutual Fund Observer, David wrote a piece about fund expenses being unreasonable to ask for lower. I do have a quick question, though, regarding that. So if assets got to be 10 times what they are or some certain level, is there a possibility that there could be some reduction in fees down the road because of size capabilities? Thanks.
Thanks, Richard. I'll take the first one, and I'll let Joe Reed at Aston take the second, as he can talk about the fund in particular. As far as it relates to asset allocation and where we fit or where we think we fit in an allocation, you know, we know that the way we do it, and 100% of our net worth in it is no recommendation at all, but we believe in it. So Daniel and I actually did a little work on this just to see, you know, kind of how we fit. And what we learned was that as you move, you know, from an equity portfolio to a 60-40 model, in fact, a lot of the partners here at River Road kind of view this more as an equity substitute, even more so than an alternative investment. So a lot of guys here have taken that 60% piece of their equity portfolio and cut that in half almost. We know they'll do us at 30 and then their other equities at another 30. And if you run through those numbers and you know kind of since we started, it produces a much more attractive Sharpe ratio. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's you're getting a lot more return per unit of risk that you're taking. So I think it's also, you know, just how comfortable you are with the strategy. Do you really understand, you know, what's going on? Because a lot of our peers that we've looked at, it's hard for me to figure out exactly what they're doing. It's a bit black boxy. So we try to keep it simple, and that's what we think about that. And Joe, if you want to say something about the fund expenses, that would be great.
Yeah, I thought I'd get out of this call without having to talk. My name is Joe Reed. I'm with the Aston Mutual Fund family. And to answer the question, the net expense ratio on the mutual fund is capped at 1.70. Now, obviously, that doesn't take into account total operating expenses, which will go up and down. But the total net expense ratio, when you pull up the ticker ARLFX on Morningstar.com or any of the sites out there, it will be 1.7. We are hopeful that next year there will be an institutional share class available, which we anticipate to be 25 basis points cheaper. But as most mutual funds go, as more assets come in, there is a correlation to the lowering of that expense ratio. So there is no mathematical formula for every 10 to 20 million that come in. It goes down X basis points, but we would anticipate it being lowered.
Great. Thank you.
Great. And I'm afraid with that, we're going to have to end the call as we've kind of hit the top of the hour. I want to thank both Joe and the folks from River Road for joining us this evening. I wanted to let you folks know that on January 1st, with our January issue, we will post both a kind of review of this call and an MP3, which is downloadable in case you'd like to listen to this while you're working out at the gym. And I wanted you to know, too, that we're working on a series or with negotiating with a series of other management teams, the nice folks at Matthews Asia Growth and Income, the folks at Seafarer Overseas, as well as a couple kind of focused long-only managers, Breton and River Park Wedgwood, so that in the months ahead we can continue to give you access to folks who are really smart, articulate, and deeply committed to strategies that have, over time, proven to be winners for the folks who have trusted in them. And so with that, I'd like to thank you all for your patience. I would like to wish you all a very fine holiday season and invite you back next month as we continue this exploration. Thank you, friends.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.